The Boston Marathon has a long, well-documented history of cheaters. Like that time Rosie Ruiz hitched a ride on the Boston T 10 miles into the race.
Well, it was a fantastic performance, Rosie. Congratulations. Rosie Ruiz, the mystery woman winner. We missed her at all our checkpoints. She came through the finish in a fantastic 2:31. We have to confirm that time at this point, but she was way ahead of a world-class field here today in the Boston Marathon.
So, yeah, she was stripped of that title. And then there's this armchair investigator who claims to have found at least 47 people who cheated back in 2015 by taking someone else's bib or by taking shortcuts in the qualifying marathon. Oh, and then there's this thriving marketplace where people say they'd be willing to spend as much as $5,000 to get their hands on someone else's starting number. And so maybe it's no surprise that this year, once again, a high-profile Boston Marathon finish is being called into question. But there it was. The day after the race, images of a runner's dramatic finish were splashed on the cover of the Boston Globe and featured on every major TV news channel. It was powerful stuff. But on the internet, he was being accused of cheating.
To me, it would have been considered he should have been a DNF.
A DNF, as in, did not finish. The cheater in question is Ari Ofsivit, and he's a friend of mine.
So, there are people who say you cheated.
So, there's cheating. I think with cheating, you have to have intent. People were saying things like, he shouldn't have accepted the aid from those guys. Well, you know what? I didn't really have the opportunity to say that because my brain was not functioning.
Today on Outside In, the story of my friend Ari, his 15 minutes of fame, and a bigger question. What's a race like the Boston Marathon for? Is it for you and me and the community? Or is it a race, damn it? Quit screwing around. So what the heck happened? Who is this person who's being accused of cheating in the Boston Marathon?
Yeah, so this is sort of typical. It's 6:00 in the morning. And running over to Harvard Stadium.
Ari is a guy who I met while doing cross-country ski races. He's really skinny, tall, lives in Boston. I've hung out with him maybe a half dozen times, but I'd say we're both from the same world. People who like running and biking a lot. Some might describe us as extreme, but I prefer enthusiasts. The morning that I visited Ari, he was headed to sprint up and down the steps of the Harvard Stadium with 300 or so other people. It's quite the scene.
Game time.
What time is it?
Game time.
This convergence of masochists is a thing called the November Project. They swear a lot, which, sorry.
Y'all good?
Yeah.
Y'all good?
Yeah.
What time is it?
Game time.
What time is it?
These are Ari's people. They actually call themselves a tribe. And if you want to get to know somebody, who better to ask than his tribe?
Good morning!
Good morning!
Who is Ari Ofsivit?
Who is Ari? Ari is one of our badass tribe members who seems to crush the stairs every time he comes.
He's passionate about the things that he cares about. And I really think that is, I'm going to use the word lovely. I think that is a lovely thing.
Ari, he's fast as and he doesn't quit.
If I were to sum up Ari for people who've never met him, I'd say he's kind of an odd duck, but in sort of the most charming and earnest way imaginable. So that's Ari. But isn't this what they always say about criminals? He seemed like such a nice young man. So how does a sort of front-of-the-middle-of-the-pack runner, fueled by a joyful, passionate, decidedly nerdy love for his sports, wind up all over the cover of the front page of a big newspaper and on every major network news channel, accused of cheating in the most famous marathon in North America. Well, it'll help to know what happened. Just to lay out the stakes here, this was Ari's second Boston Marathon. The year before, he had run the race in 3 hours and 7 seconds, just 8 seconds away from a sub-3-hour marathon. So he's highly motivated to go faster this year. His preparation for the race the day before was pretty reasonable. Ari hydrated, he slept in his own bed, and he woke up before his alarm. And that day, Marathon Monday, was just beautiful.
The spectators all thought it was a great day because it was 65 and sunny. I like to say it was sneaky warm.
So anyway, beautiful day. He's at the start. He's well hydrated, just like a lot of other marathon runners.
Every guy in the race walks over to this fence, and it's just like shoulder to shoulder. Like if you were in a large restroom at a sports arena and everyone's in their urinals, except it's just a fence in someone's yard.
Ari gets into position, a sub-3-hour finish on his mind. That's 6 minutes and 40 seconds a mile. And then the race starts.
So the first 17 miles, I felt great. And I was, you know, every so often you'd run through a town and you raise your arms up in the air, which I'm doing right now.
He's cranking along.
632, 635.
His pace is on track to beat 3 hours.
626, 637.
I was drinking every water stop.
He sees his tribe out at one of the water stops. He sees his sister at another.
And I gave her a big high five and I grabbed some Gatorade.
As the race wears on, he hits the hills.
701.
Starts to slow down.
717.
Starts to hurt.
653.
But nothing unusual.
Most people are going to feel pretty lousy on those hills.
705.
But he's slowing down.
715. 726. 745.
But the end is in sight. He turns the corner onto Boylston Street, the final stretch.
I remember thinking, all right, legs, go.
And that thought was the last thing he remembers before waking up in the intensive care unit 4 hours later.
And apparently the first thing I said was, well, it's my time, because that's what matters.
Because you're a runner.
Because I'm a runner.
It was this four-hour period, this time when Ari was lights out, that got him into trouble. This is when Ari's alleged cheating happened. But he had zero memory. He finally saw what happened on that last finishing stretch the same way that I did, by watching the news footage.
His is a story that's not about a near collapse just shy of the finish line, or of a body temperature that nearly caused organ...
Ari had overheated. Hyperthermia.
I made it to 200 feet from the finish line before I started to stumble.
...caused his limping body to zigzag down Boylston Street.
You can see it on the news footage. Just before the finishing line, Ari started to collapse. But this is the Boston Marathon. In a race this big, you are always surrounded by other people. So as he's weaving back and forth, beginning to stumble, losing consciousness, other runners are there. Before he even hits the ground, he has a guy by each side and another behind him, all of them hoisting him back to his feet. Slowly, they get Ari to the finish. One under each arm, his legs moving almost like he's trying to help, but they're totally ineffective. It's almost like this parody of running. His head is rolling from side to side and front to back.
So I was at 108.8 degrees.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
What the hell's happening in your body when you're at 108, almost 109 degrees?
109 degrees. Something has gone very wrong when you're at 109. Basically, under 104 is a fever. Above 104, you start running into neurological issues. You're significantly over 104, you basically have a 30-minute clock that starts ticking when you go over. What you can have happen is multiple times of organ failure, and certainly death is within the realm of possibility.
The two runners get him across the finish line. And within seconds, he's in a wheelchair. The first aid staff rush him into a tent where they stick him into a tub full of ice.
I actually had scratches in my chest from where they were rubbing ice into my chest.
In their haste to cool him off, the first responders actually overcorrected. And when they sent him off to the hospital, he was actually hypothermic. His body temperature was down around 84 degrees by the time he got there. The doctor actually gave a press conference to talk about Ari's state when he got to the emergency room.
Pale, completely white almost, with his lips were blue. He was unresponsive and shivering.
But this is a big hospital in a major city. He's got basically the best care in the world. And so a few hours later, he wakes up. Ari didn't break the 3-hour mark, but he did get a time, a very respectable 3 hours and 3 minutes. You can find his name on the results sheet. He finished in 1,848th place. And like all the finishers, he got a medal. But the next day...
The front page of the Boston Globe was the men's winner, the women's winner, and me.
While he was unconscious, Ari's finish had become a viral internet moment. And it's that image of him being carried across the finish line that in certain parts of the running community showed he was just another cheater.
To me, it would have been considered he should have been a DNF.
This is Jay Curry. He's an OR nurse, a cyclist, and a triathlete. He's never done the Boston Marathon, but he has done Ironman triathlons. That's where you run a marathon after swimming 2.4 miles and biking 112. I found him through a Facebook comment he left underneath one of the articles about Ari.
It kind of takes away from the sport if anybody can just pick people up and carry them across the line, or I could jump on a bus and say, geez, I'm kind of tired right now. I got 2 miles to go. I'll just call a taxi and take a taxi to the finish line and then be considered a finisher.
Jay was really explicit when he talked to me. He has no ill will toward Ari, and he doesn't think he deliberately cheated. But he's steadfast. Ari did not finish. He gives an example. In triathlons, drafting, where one cyclist follows closely behind another to cut back on air resistance, is against the rules.
You're not supposed to draft. I know that I'm not going to win, but I'm still not going to draft out there. If I get seen drafting, even though I'm not going to win, I'm still going to get penalized for that.
And Jay's not alone. For every 10 people who celebrate his finish as a story about good sportsmanship and community, there are one or two that say, nice story, but he should be disqualified. Albert Shank is one of them. He's a Spanish teacher and a marathoner from Arizona.
But you're toeing the line and running the same exact course at the same time as these elite runners from Kenya and Ethiopia and the United States and all over the world. And so I think you should be subjected to the same rules as they are.
2 days after the race, a conversation about Ari pops up on the forum section of a website called letsrun.com. This website is totally anonymous. It's kind of like the subconscious or the id of the competitive running community. The title of the thread was Another Boston Cheat, which seems pretty harsh. Is it really cheating to get help in a medical emergency? Not really.
There's no question of, oh, do you run by the guy lying on the ground or you help him out? Oh, let's run by him. He should be fine. I guess maybe.
Maybe give him a little kick on the way. Hey.
Yeah, kick the guy on the ground. Oh, we don't want to help him cheat. Ooh, hey, do you want some help, buddy? No. If we help you, you're cheating. No one does that.
But when it comes to this question of whether he deserves to be considered a finisher, I think this is a fair point. Think of it this way. If Ari had been in first place, he definitely would have been disqualified. This actually happened in the Olympic marathon in 1908. Durando Pietri, an Italian, had to be helped to his feet by the course umpires when he collapsed 5 times in the last 400 meters. The second place finisher, an American, protested, and Pietri lost his gold medal. But there's a big difference between an Olympic athlete and Ari Ofsivit. Hell, there's a big difference between the front of the Boston Marathon and Ari Ofsivit.
I understand that there are folks out there in the world that a rule is a rule is a rule. I get it. And God bless them for feeling that way.
This is David McGilvery, the race director of the Boston Marathon, one of the people who very well could have disqualified Ari.
I'm a hardcore guy. I've been around a long time. I've run 145 marathons. I've finished every single one of them except the first one. So I get it. I understand, per se, where they're coming from. But I also feel that no foul, no harm here. It was a gallant effort, and I feel he earned the medal, and let's move on.
Dave points out that, in reality, there are two races going on in Boston with two different sets of rules. And while it might seem like a stupid example, here's just one.
I mean, elites cannot wear headphones. They wouldn't be eligible for prize money. You know, someone say, well, there shouldn't be different rules for different people. Well, there are. You know, it's a different competitive environment. That's the beauty about a road race or about the marathon, is that you get the best of the best on the front end, but you also have the human interest, inspirational stories in the middle on the back end.
One of those races is really only about who is fastest. The other is mostly just a community building event. One that would be totally ruined if you militantly disqualified thousands of people who did things like take water from someone other than an officially sanctioned water stop. But some of the complaints circle around the prestigiousness of the Boston Marathon. It's really tough to qualify for it, and so many people register that if you just barely make the time cut, you still might get turned away. Because he finished, Ari will likely qualify for next year's marathon, and he could be taking a spot from a runner who finished the race on their own 2 feet. But let's go back to Jay Curry. For Jay, this is clearly about some sort of personal code.
I personally myself would not feel comfortable saying that I finished the race if I didn't do the distance on my own. When the first time I did Lake Placid, they were threatening to cancel part of the swim because of a thunder and lightning storms coming at it. And we were all mad, like, what? I'm only going to be able to do, maybe not even be able to do the swim. Well, that's not the Ironman.
This, to me, is a case of people who hold themselves to really high standards. People who would be angry with themselves for collapsing before the finish. Here's Albert Shank again, from Arizona.
When I did the Whiskey Row Marathon 1 year, I don't remember which year it was, but there was this guy handing out bananas, not at an aid station. He was just at a house along the route, handing out bananas and squirting everybody with a hose if you wanted it, because it can get hot at that race.
Right.
And I did not accept the bananas because I was afraid I'd get disqualified for taking outside aid. I did ask for the hose to be squirted on me because it was a hot year.
And I mean, this sort of gets to it, right? Like you didn't take the banana, but you let the guy spray you with the hose.
Exactly. That seems a little bit of a contradiction.
Well, sort of. I mean, it sort of depends, right?
Yeah, I think my main point wasn't so much as receiving the aid, but actually physically being carried.
So, who gets the final word? I'm going to give it to Meb. Meb Keflezighi, Olympic silver medalist, winner of the 2014 Boston Marathon, and general goodwill ambassador for the sport of long-distance running. He actually tweeted a photo of the guys carrying Ari across the finish line. It said, hashtag support, hashtag character, hashtag whatever it takes. It did not say, hashtag obvious DQ.
Meb, when he tweeted, said something about this being the spirit of the Boston, not this guy should be, you know, if Meb doesn't think I should be disqualified on the spot, I probably shouldn't be.
So there you have it. If you don't like the fact that Ari got a finishing time, take it up with Meb. Marathoners are a unique bunch. Some might say they're gluttons for punishment, but they've got nothing on this crew.
He would rather have mushrooms growing out of his underwear, if in fact he wore underwear, than he would ever be caught with his axe dull or not ready to go. You see what I'm saying?
Up next, we head up into the White Mountains to meet a group of hard scrabble misfits who get their kicks off cutting stones and chopping wood. The secrets of a legendary trail-fixing crew when Outside In returns. This is Outside In from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Sam Evans Brown. When you walk on a trail in the woods, have you ever wondered, how did this get here? Am I actually following some sort of centuries-old Native American footpath, one that follows the easiest and most natural route? Surprise! You're not. This is the sound of a team of people who have carried hundreds of pounds of equipment over a mile into the woods in order to fix a hiking trail that is falling apart. They drill holes into a big boulder, probably the size of a refrigerator, and then hammer in wedges, slowly splitting the rock into nice, flat chunks. Next, they strap the rock chunk onto a zip line, because the trail itself is actually 30 feet below the spot where they can get rocks from.
Hoist, hold!
It's a three-person job. One controls how high in the air the rock hangs, another lets it slide down along the zip line, and a third directs the whole show from below.
Belay hold!
Belay holding.
Once the rock is down, a hole gets dug. The rock gets attached to a different kind of lever and pulley setup, and using a rock bar and lots of finagling, the rock gets dropped into place. All of that, maybe 2 or 3 hours of work for three people, for a single step in a stone staircase near a nice waterfall.
People think these staircases occur naturally.
This is Nova, which is not his real name. Everyone who does this work gets assigned a woods name. His real name is Alex Mildy. He's in charge of this particular Appalachian Mountain Club work crew, which is working at a place called Champney Falls in New Hampshire's White Mountains.
We've had people do that. They've been walking down our work, talking to their kid, and we're rolling around in the dirt, clearly putting in a staircase, and they're like, yes, honey, these steps were put here by God.
This is actually the ultimate compliment to a trail builder. Using natural materials taken from nearby, they're hoping their work will blend right in, hoping that when you're halfway up a mountain, miles from the nearest road, the stone staircase you're stepping on feels as natural as the forests that surround it. And the trail makers themselves, just like their work, are practically invisible. So who does this job? Who are these trail gods?
Any trail crew guy worth his he would rather have mushrooms growing out of his underwear if, in fact, he wore underwear, than he would ever be caught with his axe dull or not ready to go. You see what I'm saying?
To talk about how trails are made, I'm going to talk about what is, as far as I can tell from my corner of the world, the most legendary trail crew around. The Appalachian Mountain Club's professional trail crew in the White Mountains. Among themselves, they're also known as the TFC.
So TFC.
TFC, came around, no one really knows where it came from. It came around in the 70s sometime. Stands for a trail crew.
This is not in any of the AMC's official literature. That comes from a second year crew member, Wood's name Aesop, who declined to tell us his real name.
Yeah, we like to say if you're telling your grandma asks what it stands for, you say trail fixing crew.
So what's with that name? This is where the mythology of this crew comes in. The first thing you might hear about the TFC is about their legendary toughness.
On Monday, everyone had at least probably about 150 pounds coming up this trail. So that's definitely on the heavier side.
That incredible understatement comes from Switchback, real name Ashley Fife, the current trail master. They carry these absurd loads on pack boards, which look something like a bed frame with shoulder straps.
What's the craziest load you've ever seen someone carry on one of those?
I saw a pack go in, and it was all steel, so we knew the weight of everything on it. And I think it came out to be about 270 pounds.
Jesus.
Now, I will say, no one actually weighed that backpack, and someone else on the same crew told me he thought it was 205 pounds. But regardless, that's crazy. Some crew members actually fight over who gets to carry the heaviest gear.
What's that feel like on your shoulders?
It's crippling.
Aesop says learning that you can carry more than you thought is a crucible that everyone on the crew has to pass through.
You have to develop a definitely strong mental attitude and a mindset to just kind of break through those pain barriers and just keep on walking one foot in front of the other.
Apart from really heavy packs, the crew also hikes really far and really fast. They do this thing called patrolling.
Patrols are the first 2 to 3 weeks of the season, and it's where we hike 12 to 22 miles a day.
They're responsible for around 365 miles of trails, clearing away trees that have blown down over the winter and hoeing out drainage ditches that have filled in with leaves and dirt. And in part because if a chainsaw breaks down when you're 15 miles into a 20-mile hike, you're sunk. And in part because of this tradition of brawn and perseverance, they clear the trees by hand with axes.
So it's just like hike, 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 chop, chop, chop.
Clear.
Ho, ho, ho.
Yep, exactly. Chop, chop,
so 22 miles in a day you'll do with stopping to do blowdowns.
Yep, yep. 5 days a week.
You know, they just used to do insane things.
That's Joan Chevalier. She was the first woman to be on the crew back in 1978. She remembers the crew had to rebuild a steep trail on the region's highest peak, Mount Washington, which meant carrying massive logs on their backs down from the summit across what is basically a boulder field called the Alpine Garden.
They all dressed up in costumes. And they packed these ridiculous logs across the Alpine Garden. And so that was just kind of one example.
It's almost like they're superhumans.
Yeah, there was kind of this mystique about them that they... there was kind of this swagger about them. That they were better, you know, they were one of the better trail crews and they could do anything. And, you know, they ate five times a normal human beings. Everything was sort of supersized.
I heard a lot of these stories from current and past members of the TFC while working on this story. Crew members deciding to hike to their next project site, which meant going 27 miles over Mount Washington, which is one of the most inhospitable peaks in the country, in the middle of the night. Crews loaded down with so much gear that they couldn't stand, or so weighed down that they tipped over in a river and struggled to get out from under their packs, or this one gruesome story of a crew member who slipped while swinging an axe at a fallen tree trunk and opened a flap of flesh on his knee that his friend said looked like a slab of raw meat. He lost a liter of blood, but still finished chopping out his blowdown tree and then hiked more than 5 miles out of the woods under his own power. And having been told these stories, even then, it felt like TFC members were holding back, like they couldn't tell me their best stories. But these stories of pure, astonishing physicality are just one part of what makes the crew legendary. Reason number two for the TFC legend, they get up to some serious shenanigans. Some of these stories have become part of the lore of the White Mountains. An example? Back in the 50s, some of the kids on the crew heard that President Eisenhower was coming to visit the state. Bob Watts was on the crew the summer this happened.
There were two or three of the trail crew and two or three of the hut crew who combined their talents and actually were successful in putting a goatee on the Old Man of the Mountains.
The Old Man was a famous rock formation in the White Mountains, which, from a distance, looked like the profile of a face. It was one of New Hampshire's most well-known icons until it fell down back in 2003. These kids from the trail crew somehow managed to tie bushes to his chin, which is 40 feet below the edge of the cliff that was the top of his face, a cliff which is hundreds of feet tall. All of this just to give him a funny little beard.
So these guys really, for almost a half a century, went into hiding and never would admit their participation in this shenanigan.
It seems like each crew gets up to some sort of foolishness. Crew members camping out in the woods during huge storms, crew members building a fake bird's nest complete with hard-boiled eggs with spots drawn on them and convincing passing hikers this was the nest of the rare alpine duck. These are hijinks, college kids in the woods. And again, this is just what they're telling me, an outsider. I can tell that there are more stories just under the surface. But you wouldn't mistake them for your typical group of college kids in the woods. And this is a third reason the TFC is legendary. Their look. Members of the crew don't look like earth-loving hippies. They're like filthy, muscled punk rockers. To match the mystique they've cultivated over the years, the crew has adopted a certain style. Mostly mohawks, which, according to Nova, is more aerodynamic?
My theory is it's also a radiator. So you get to shave the hair on the sides, so that allows a lot of heat to kind of radiate out and you evaporate. Then you have the vein of hair coming down the center, and that condenses the sweat coming off your head, and then recirculates it.
And getting grimy is expected. It's pretty much a one shower a week kind of group. John LaManna, a crew member from back in the 70s, puts it this way.
Any trail crew guy worth his he would rather have mushrooms growing out of his underwear, if in fact he wore underwear, than he would ever be caught with his axe dull or not ready to go. You see what I'm saying?
Maybe to you this sounds a little bit fratty. And it's definitely the case that most of the members of the trail crew are guys. But
the only time I really noticed, like, I'm a girl is when hikers will pass and make, like, sexist comments.
This is Anna Malvin, a.k.a. 10 Gauge, who's doing her first year on this year's crew.
I'm like, oh, why don't you get the guys up there to help you? And stuff like that. But other than that, like, I think the crew's really cool because they try really hard to not make a difference, and you try to work your hardest, and as long as you're working towards your 100%, that's, like, all they expect.
You know, AMC was one of the places where finally you could sort of eventually, you know, with the trail crew, that women and men were equal, and it didn't matter. Everybody did what they could do and made a contribution.
Which is not to say this has always been a place that a gender studies major would have 100% approved of. For instance, when Joan Chevalier got onto the crew, she had to become one of the guys because the lunchtime conversation wasn't about to get any more delicate.
So if there was a cute girl on the trail, one of them would say, yell, give me a peeler. A peeler
is a thing used to take bark off of logs. This was code for cute girl on the trail.
Give me a peeler, and all the guys would come out of the woods to come look at the female. We did not have a male equivalent of that, I have to say. But.
Maybe there's one now. I should ask.
Yeah, you should ask.
I forgot to ask. But gender aside, first years on the crew are always at the bottom of the food chain.
Well, the trail crew's been around for almost 100 years. So there's, like, things that they do that are just, like, really ingrained. I think as a first year, you don't really get hazed, but
she says there are little things, like first years having to carry out the crew's trash. And this.
We had to take a test at the beginning. Just as a joke, it was, like, what color this person's tidy whities or stuff like that. While getting, like, like little balls thrown at us.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So it's all in good fun, but yeah.
It is sort of difficult to sometimes see the line between what's hazing and what's bonding.
This is Pinesh Shah, who was on the trail crew in 2001 and 2002.
You know, like, I think a good example is, like, one of the things that they do is, you know, you're supposed to always keep track of your axe when you're on trail crew.
Pinesh once left his axe on a workbench while he ate dinner, and two upper year members, including one who would later become his wife, hid his axe behind a shed.
You know, that I think that's probably, you know, there's some element of hazing there, but there's also, you know, there is at least some purpose to that.
Right. You're being instilled, you know, with a value.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think, and you know, and ultimately it's pretty harmless, right?
Like, yeah, that's totally tame.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think you'd be able to get that quality of work product or just the amount of labor that the crew puts in for the amount they get paid unless there was some other benefit, right? And that benefit is pride.
Pride and cohesion. And friendship. One crew member told me it was like being in an Air Force squadron or an infantry platoon. Another I interviewed said, everything felt right when she was on trail crew. Like, she had figured out what was important. And when she came back to college, it was like everyone else was still so confused.
This trail crew job, this is not something that they just drop in out of the sky and work for a summer in the woods in the White Mountains. They might think that way when they plan to get here, but they find out quite soon that it's different.
Ben English was on the crew in the 50s. To this day, he and John LaManna still hike up to visit today's trail crew at their various projects out in the woods. I talked to the two of them by a waterfall, near where the crew was completing a staircase. You could tell they were incredibly proud of their time on crew and of the work that the crew does. You could also tell that they were deeply uncomfortable with talking about this very special, kind of secret part of their life on the radio.
We could tell them about it. Tony, in the fire pond there, we could tell them that. We can't tell them that story, man.
No, I don't think we... I know we can't.
We can't tell them that. Because Tony could still be alive.
Yeah. So there's stories that are too good for radio.
Oh, yeah.
We have to maintain a certain mystique about us, right?
Definitely right.
I mean, we don't want the whole friggin' world knowing how good this is, because they'll all want to do it.
You get this shut off.
I can shut it off if you want.
Well, yeah, because I think that...
We don't want it off.
And with that, we cut off the tape. I guess if you want to hear these stories, you might have to just join up yourself, if you think you can hack it. Okay, clearly it takes a lot of brawn to do trail work, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's not the toughest physical activity out there. Sorry, TFC. When it comes to pure endurance and pain, the Oh My God, This Is Brutal award goes to cross-country skiing. Sorry, TFC. When it comes to pure endurance and pain, the Oh My God, This Is Brutal award goes to cross-country skiing.
And childbirth.
And childbirth.
Don't forget childbirth.
My producer is telling me the childbirth is also the worst. But our next story is about cross-country skiing. Specifically, one Olympic skier who made a split-second decision that helped me to become a ski champ in Argentina. How's that for a tease? Outside In, we'll be right back. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. If you've been listening to the show, you might have caught on to the fact that I do a lot of endurance sports, and I often make these self-effacing comments about how I'm not very fast, because to me that's true. Compared to the best athletes in the sports that I do, I'm not very good. But to my colleagues, these comments are stupid, because they're comparing me to the general public. And recently, I told them something that really drove them crazy. In 2008, I raced an Olympic skier in one of the biggest races in Argentina. And I won. But the story I'm going to tell you today isn't actually about me. It's about the Olympian in that race, a man named Martin Bianchi, a man who made a split-second decision that would change the course of his athletic career and his outlook on life.
Bueno, yo estuve en Torino en el año 2006. Con 24 años.
That's Martin. And what he just said is that when he was 24, he went to the Winter Olympics in Torino, Italy. He's from Ushuaia, which is the southernmost city in the world. It's one of the cities that scientific voyages to Antarctica depart from. Martin grew up at the foot of the Andes and started skiing when he was little.
Y mi padre me llevó al poco tiempo a hacer esquí.
Before long, my dad took me to try cross-country skiing, and I fell in love immediately.
Inmediato.
He got on skis for the first time when he was 9 years old. And by the time he was 14, it was clear he was talented.
Cuando el mejor esquiador del momento,
Argentina's best skier at the time suggested that I should travel to Europe. And he got me a job so that I could sleep and eat and train at the ski center, which was in Spain, the first time that I traveled.
For years, he chased the snow. He would spend the Northern Hemisphere's winters in Spain, racing in the mountains of the Pyrenees, and then come home and go to school and have another ski season, racing in Ushuaia. There are not many cross-country skiers in Argentina, and Martin was very quickly national champion and a local hero. He was a shoo-in for the Olympics, but in 2002, for Salt Lake City, he had a problem.
I had to have surgery on my knee. I had an injury. And I decided that wasn't how I wanted to participate after having been injured. So I decided not to go. Today, I think that I made a mistake because I could have been in two Olympics instead of just one. But these are decisions that get made when you're young and haven't had many experiences.
So Martin got back on the horse. Another 4 years of training, 4 years of working in exchange for room and board, another round of qualification races. And in 2006, at 24, Martin heads to Torino. He had only done well enough to qualify for one race.
And out of about 100 competitors, I finished 86th, so I was pretty close to last place.
Such is the fate of skiers from countries without any real national teams, coaches, support networks, or competitive race circuits. You spend your whole life training and then wind up 86th. And when he came back, he couldn't quite let go. Back home, Martin was still the best. There was no clear successor. So even though he'd gotten married right before the Olympics and was thinking about having kids, he kept training.
There's always something that's calling you back to the trails. At that time, it was that there weren't many athletes behind me. It was like, if I quit, there wouldn't be anybody.
He got a job teaching phys ed to kindergartners part-time.
Well, because in order to train on that level, you have to have a part-time job. It's hard to have a full-time job.
I asked him if he could support a family with what he was earning.
No.
So this was the state of things when I met Martin. He was still training like he was going to the Olympics. His life was kind of on hold, but he wasn't going to the Olympics. When I was 22, I was obsessed with cross-country ski racing. I never seriously thought I was going to the Olympics, but I was pretty into it. And at one point, I was ranked pretty well nationally. So in the summer of 2008, I flew to Ushuaia to train. Remember, it's the Southern Hemisphere, so it was their winter. I found a gig helping out at a restaurant that was next to the ski trails down there. I slept above the kitchen, even though the building had no heat and no electricity once the generator that provided it with power went off for the day. I would wash dishes for a few hours in the afternoon, help with any tourists who had stayed for snowshoe tours in the evening, but the rest of the time, I was just skiing, hours every day. All that training led up to the big event in Ushuaia, a race called the Marcha Blanca. Historically, back before competitive cross-country skiing was all about Lycra and the lightweight, narrow skis that require carefully groomed snow, the race used to cross over the spine of the Andes. Today, it's a pretty standard 13-mile ski race that's also kind of a festival.
Maybe the best way to understand our cross-country skiing culture in Tierra del Fuego is to go to the Marcha Blanca.
Hundreds of people show up to race and to watch the Marcha Blanca, including many who have hardly ever skied and they come wearing costumes. But there are a few competitive racers in the pack. And that is how I found myself on a starting line with Martin Bianchi. The race immediately separated into a pack of five skiers, and then four, and then after just a few minutes, there were only three of us. Martin Bianchi, Federico Cicero, a skier who would later go on to race in Sochi, and me. Now, the course of the Marcha Blanca is a single 21-kilometer loop. It weaves in and out of the forest, but the majority of it travels over big, open plains of frozen peat moss. And all throughout those forests and frozen bogs, there's a hidden hazard lurking.
In those particular years, we were experiencing a plague.
Que es el castor.
The beaver.
That's right, beavers.
El castor se trajo aquí en el año 46.
Beavers were brought here in 1946 for fur hats and clothing. And later, when that didn't work out, they had the bright idea of just letting them go. And when they released the 10 pairs of beavers that there were at the time, they bred and populated the entire island. Now they estimate there are over 90,000 beavers.
Beavers, in Tierra del Fuego, are an invasive species. How about that?
Y impacta también en las pistas de esquí.
And it has an impact on the ski trails. Often, they simply build up a dam and flood the trail. So we have to do a lot of beaver control, and back then, they weren't doing it.
No se hacía.
So we're skiing along, traipsing across snow-covered peat moss and beaver bogs, and within the group, things were pretty tight.
Bueno, a ver.
Well, if I remember right, we were trading off who was leading as we went, and I knew in that moment that I could win. Because we were about on par with each other, and I had faith that in the final big climb, I could get some distance on you. But I got a big surprise, and I'm being sincere here, Sam, that before that climb, which they call the Subida de los Hacheros, I couldn't pass you. And so I climbed the hill behind you without being able to pass you, going maybe a little slower than I would have liked to go, because generally, I'm good at going uphill. When we got to the top of the climb, we had to turn sharply to the right and go downhill. And this downhill ended by going over a beaver bog, much to your surprise. The ski tracks, which you normally get into the tracks when you go down a hill, the tracks went over a beaver dam. And the track setting machine had passed over that, so the tracks weren't level, and they sort of threw you into a jump. This downhill was very fast. It was short, but very steep. And when we finished the climb and started to go down, we got into the tracks. I looked ahead and saw that the tracks went over a rock, and I immediately realized there was a jump there. And there, still ahead of me, you hit the rock and went off the jump.
Sin querer.
Without meaning to. You were knocked off balance and you went off the trail.
Y yo pasé.
And I passed you. I was able to avoid and go around you. And it was in that moment that I said, well, that's it. It's over.
Ya está.
I passed you with all the speed from this downhill slope. So right there, I took 15, 20 meters from you, easy. And you still had to make your way back onto the trail and regain your momentum. So I had this fantastic opportunity to go, to keep hammering and leave you behind.
Pero para serte sincero,
but to tell you the truth, something happened in my head that told me this wasn't right. You had climbed the hill well, you had done the downhill well. The only thing is that you hadn't noticed that the trail had a jump in it. And it was because of that jump that you went off the trail. You lost all your momentum. And to me, the right thing to do seemed to be to wait for you.
I didn't fall, but I was standing way off the trail with deep, heavy, powdery snow up to my knees or so. And I remember my heart just sinking into my stomach. We were not far from the finish, and I was almost positive that the race was over. But then I looked over and I saw that Martin had slowed down. As he glided past, he looked back over his shoulder and I heard him call out.
Venga, Sam, algo así, porque te dije, ¿no? En español.
I flailed my way out of the powder and frantically skied back up the hill trying to catch Martin. Given how slow he was going, it didn't take long before the racing came back together and it was nip and tuck again. The rest of the event was a bit of a blur. Right before the finish, our race merged into the trail being used by the more popular event with people skiing in costumes.
We were sprinting, dodging people left and right. You were shouting, I was shouting. It was a mess. When there were just 500 meters left, this I remember. I was pretty tired. And I saw you with this drive, this energy. That's when I realized you were going to beat me.
Y ahí me di cuenta como que, bueno, que me ibas a ganar.
And I did. For me, that was the end of the story. I won a race, they gave me a trophy, I went home, and having won the National Ski Championship of Argentina was an eccentric biographical detail that I could share at parties. But then, years later, an email arrives in my inbox from Martin. It turns out there was something else that happened that day, something I had completely forgotten. After the race, I came up to him.
And you asked me, you came up to me and you asked, Martin, you waited for me when I fell? I said, yeah, sure, Sam. I waited because I wanted us to have a clear winner. And we left it at that. But later, when we're at the award ceremony, you tried to give me the cup, the trophy. I said, no, you keep it. And at that moment, there was someone from the Argentine Olympic Committee at the ceremony. He asked me why you had tried to give me the trophy, and I told him what had happened. I told him the whole story. And for that year, 2008, they decided that the most exemplary gesture of sportsmanship in all of Argentina was this situation that happened in the Marcha Blanca. So they invited me to Buenos Aires for a dinner, a very big deal, a gala banquet, and they gave me a prize in front of all of the Olympic medalists from Argentina.
This included the Argentine soccer team, who had won the gold medal in Beijing that year. Just imagine, this would be like standing up in front of a room full of people like LeBron James and Kobe Bryant, all the most famous athletes in the country. He met his country's equivalent of Bob Costas, the Olympics host for NBC. And had an article written about him in the country's biggest newspaper.
Bueno, fue un muy grato recuerdo.
This was one of my best memories. So this race is going to stay with me for the rest of my life. And after getting this prize, I think it was kind of like a signal that things were all right, that I could retire, that I had done enough. I had left enough of a mark on the sport.
Now, when Martin races, he does it for fun. Today he has three kids, a job in the Ministry of Tourism, which pays much better than a part-time phys ed teacher. He's hung up his commitment to ski racing, but not his love for it.
The next year, just to give you an idea, in 2009, I did the Marcha Blanca in a tiger costume. I went from having been on the podium with you, second place, to the next year putting on a tiger costume and skiing the race together with my wife. That was how I ended my racing career.
Así fue mi corte de competencia.
Outside In is produced by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Maureen McMurray, Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, and Jimmy Gutierrez. Special thanks to Martin Bianchi for giving me the big win, and to Luis Antonio Perez for helping out with Spanish translation and being Martin's voice in English. Also thanks to Weldon Johnson, former Yale runner and co-founder of Let's Run, and to former TFC members Kyle Peckham and Natalie Beitel, who are assembling a book of stories from people from the crew, and Barbara Witten of the Trail Crew Association. Thanks as well to Rob Burbank of the AMC and Christine Bailey of the National Forest Service for setting up our day on the trail. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder, additional music today by Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, Tyler Gibbon. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.